Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today we're going to do something unusual on the radio. Take you on a tour of the Art of the North Gallery in the new Rasmussen wing of the Anchorage Museum. It's only been open a few months, and the new gallery showcases more than 250 pieces from the museum's permanent collection, a huge increase over the 50 pieces available before this gallery opened. I went on a guided walkthrough of this new space last November. Beyond seeing the work, much of the wonder and learning is in the stories behind the art and the artists, stories that stick with you and humanize the experience. Here to tell some of those stories are my guests. Curator Bettany Porter, joining us from Portland, Oregon, where she now teaches. Welcome, Bettany.
Thank you.
So happy to have you, and thanks for taking time out of your teaching schedule. I also have artist and art historian Kes Woodward in the KUAC studios in Fairbanks, where he lives. Welcome, Kes.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. Happy to be here.
Really happy to have you. I feel like I can just about see you. And we may be joined by Aaron Leggett. We are expecting him from the Anchorage Museum. He's the curator of Alaska History and Culture, and he would be in the studio with me, and he may just pop in as we move along. So if you have not been to the Art of the North Gallery, that's your homework. Take these stories with you when you go. But we also have a slideshow of some of the works we'll be talking about today. You can find the slideshow at alaskapublic.org. Just click on the radio tab and select Hometown Alaska. And we also invite our listeners to share questions and impressions about these artists and the gallery, and we'd love to hear from you. So you can give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage, or statewide it's 1-888-353-5752, or we welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So let's get started. Bettany, I wanted to begin with you because that November day, I think it was like November 7th or 8th, I saw something in the paper that said, come on down, take a tour of the new Art of the North Gallery. And I had been watching in the news that this was going to happen. I knew it had opened, but I'd been traveling and hadn't been able to go to the gallery. And so I thought, oh, this is a wonderful opportunity. And you welcomed us, and also Kes Woodward was there. And it was just a really fruitful walkthrough. So I know our listeners can't stand in that beautiful opening room of the Art of the North Gallery, but could you, Bettany, kind of describe the space, the height, the light, and kind of what's in that room, and then take us through the other rooms just in a general way so people can kind of get a picture in their minds?
Certainly. So when you come into the Anchorage Museum, if you go into the atrium space, which used to be kind of part of the original building, there's a giant staircase, and at the top of that on the second floor, it opens up into the new expansion, which is an additional 31,000 square feet. So you walk up the stairs into a white gallery that is 36-foot tall ceilings, wood floors, reclaimed heart pine floors, and then at the end of each gallery, there's a window sort of atria viewing space where you can see views of downtown, and it also lets in natural northern light.
That's really stunning because all of my other visits to the museum, I never had that much light and that much airy space visible. And of course, the first thing you see in that room is what's known as, I think, Everything I Love Is Here, a piece by Alvin Amazon, which really takes up that giant, giant wall. Could you talk a little bit about that one, Bettany?
Sure. We were interested in finding a piece large enough for that space. A lot of our collection, the largest things sometimes are only 13 feet, and that's about a 30-foot wall. So we, in looking at the space, decided to commission an artist's work by a living artist, contemporary artist. And we were interested in also including really the indigenous perspective of the north and the landscape. So that room in the past, when we had it down in the first floor galleries, was a landscape gallery. So we were thinking about large-scale landscape and really incorporating a variety of perspectives. So we had talked about potential artists to include, and Alvin Amazon has been working for a long time. He lives in Anchorage, has a studio. He's originally from Kodiak.
That's right, Kodiak, yeah.
Kodiak, mm-hmm. yes. And so he took a perspective on really wanting to sort of own that wall and really make a dynamic piece that filled the space. And he worked a lot with imagery that related to stories and anecdotes from his personal life and his relationship to the landscape and living on the coast. So we see imagery of water and fish and seal and also a float plane. And he talks about the sound, how that became a part of kind of feelings of home as the sound of the planes. And in particular, he's referencing pilot Steve Harvey. So he has titles often for his pieces that are sometimes quotes of something someone said, or in this case, referring to some stories about the fish in the piece on the left. He talks about his grandmother making a soup that had fish eyes in it and how that was sort of this idea of the nutrition of that. And so it was very much wrapped up in his sort of relationship to the landscape in a really different way than some of the other paintings in that room.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to interject briefly here, Bettany, that last Friday, the museum hosted a talk by Alvin Amazon, and he did talk about this specific piece of art, but he also talked about growing up in Kodiak and his connection to the land. And I think Perry Eaton was in a little video with Alvin talking about sense of place that is often arises in local artwork. But he did tell one funny story that I'm just going to tell you really fast. He said that he was talking to his grandfather, I think, and he was curious why salmon jump. And he told the audience, well, maybe, you know, he thought maybe it was because of sea lice and they were irritated by the sea lice, or maybe there was something else about breaking the eggs. And it just, you know, he was just wondering. And I think it was his grandfather, and his grandfather said, salmon jump because they want to see where they're at. And that's the kind of way that he gets some of the titles of his paintings, you know, from stories like that. And, you know, the one called Good Medicine in that large piece comes directly from his mother or grandmother and telling them to eat the fish soup because it was good medicine. So, yeah, he's very grounded, and it was a real treat to get to hear him talk about his artwork. And his connection to Kodiak and just the way he takes what he sees and puts it on canvases. One of the things people might be interested in, for example, there's a big bear in that picture, and it's many colors. You know, it's not a brown bear. And he talked about how there are many colors in the black of a jay, you know, the black feathers. It's almost luminescent, and that kind of inspired him to get all these different colors into his paintings. And one other thing he said, and then I'll stop talking because you guys are the experts, but he talked about why he has so many projections. Like he'll have, there's a seal, I think, on one side of the painting where the float plane is, and it projects out into the room, and the snout of a bear projects out into the room. And he talked about why he did that. And there were a couple reasons. One was then he doesn't have to worry about making shadows on a flat plane. These projected features can make their own shadows. But he also talked about growing up in the Russian Orthodox Church, where there were shelves everywhere in the church, and that gave him an idea of having shelves or having things that project out. So it was just kind of funny to hear that from the artist. And I've always wondered about his work, why it was so colorful, and then to hear him explain why was really satisfying. So, but Bettany, I have another question for you. And Kes, don't hesitate to chime in here. If
let me just chime in just a second about Alvin then. Because
yes, please do.
Alvin is a great friend. He taught here at the university in Fairbanks for a number of years, and his office was right next to mine, and we've had exhibitions together. That piece is as magnificent as the room that it's in, and both of them are just about unique in terms of scale and impact for art in Alaska. And I would have loved to have been at Alvin's talk, because he's one of the few artists I know who talks as engagingly about his work and about his life as he makes art about it. And you can tell that when you hear him talk, you can tell it when you look at his paintings, that he's experienced these things and he has such a personal take on them. and he brings them to life in a way that really no other Alaskan artist has.
You know, what something else he said about that piece called Everything I Love Is Here, the bear, he said that he had painted it and it wasn't right, and he scraped the paint off, and he talked about, you know, the struggle to get it just the way he wants it, and also the quality of the eyes, whether it's an otter or a seal or a bear, that the way they are looking at you, he said it's a window into the soul of the animal. And if you look at the eyes in his, they are really remarkable. They almost look like they could wink at you, or that they're really real, you know. And so that was just another thing that I thought of that he talked about.
He paints the eyes of animals better than anybody I know, and you wouldn't believe it to see him do that. And Alvin, the way Alvin works, he has lots and lots of little paper cups of different colors out on the table in front of him, and he paints really quickly and really freely and loosely. And he does those eyes with just a few strokes, and if it doesn't work, he does it again. And it's you can see that kind of freshness in the work. But it's really piercing in its truthfulness to the reality of looking into the eyes of an animal.
And Bedney, I just want to sort of, well, first of all, I'm going to throw out our numbers and also let folks know, if you just tuned in, who's on the phone with me today. We have Bedney Porter, who curated the Art of the North Gallery, which just opened last September. And we also have Kes Woodward with us. He's calling us from KUAC studios up in Fairbanks, which we want to say thank you to the studio for facilitating this. And if you want to share any view of your own stepping into that gallery, we're just talking now about that first room, which is just really stunning. Give us a call at 550-8433 or give us an email. If you've got questions about the art there, or you just want to share what that experience was like for you. But back to you, Bedney. There's a big Sidney Lawrence in that room. There is a collection of pieces by George Brown of Denali. There is, I think, Kes, isn't there one of your birch images there also?
Yep. There's a big one.
Yeah. And, you know, when you gave the walkthrough, Bedney, you talked about, well, you know, we toyed with putting the Sidney Lawrence on that big wall, but then it would have required other pieces. And now it's kind of off by itself and very majestic looking. And, you know, that leads me to sort of say, how did you decide what to put in that first room?
Sure. Well, part of the idea was to have large-scale landscape in that space, and we were also thinking about that in terms of building the room that large to really think about the type of scale that we think about when we think about the Alaskan landscape as a place. So that was a big part of it. And thinking about the Sidney on that wall, it would have had a lot of negative space left over on either side. So then you have the problem of, do we put another painting there? Do we put a label text? And if you do that, that visual relationship starts to change the meaning of both of them. And so it would, in a lot of the sample layouts that I tried, it was sort of taking the focus away from both paintings, or you had to have an odd number. And it just wasn't working scale-wise. So putting it on the wall that we did right at the front entrance really made it shine and gave it the appropriate sort of scale of wall to match the enormousness of that frame, and the also thinking about that as a hook to sort of bring people up into the space. They are constantly asking about it when they come to the museum, and so to see it and kind of lead your eye into that space and say, here's the new Art of the North Gallery, it seemed like an interesting starting point. And also putting the Albert Bierstadt painting to the right of it, and thinking about how a lot of our collection is really focused on the romantic landscape from the late 1800s, early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And sort of starting with some of that, but also interrupting that with having contemporary works like Nicholas Galanin's piece in the center of the room, and really kind of thinking about the idea of whose idea of North it is and what that all sort of means. So it's a range of time periods in that room, and it's also a range of materials, and moving from flat representational paintings to abstraction and then also into sculpture. And we have artists in that room working in sort of traditional methods as well as contemporary methods, and then everything sort of in between, with Alvin being kind of the bridge between full, you know, three-dimensional sculpture or flat painting.
And would you describe the piece in the center of the room? I believe it's like a totem, is it not, that's been dismantled? I might be remembering that wrong.
Yes, it is. It's called, I think it goes like this, and it's a cut-up totem pole that's chopped up and reassembled abstractly, sort of like a pile of firewood almost. And so the signs or the images, you know, the order is all sort of intermixed, and so you can't read it in the way that you might a full totem. And then the other idea is that it was taken from an Indonesian curio knockoff totem that was claiming to be, you know, Alaska Native in sort of imagery and culture, but it wasn't made here, and it wasn't made by an Alaska Native. And so Nicholas Glannon is taking that idea and really questioning what happens when you remove something from its culture, when you appropriate it and make it a curiosity object or a
collectible.
Yeah, and what does that do to the meaning, and and is that okay, and why would we accept that so readily? So by taking back the image, deconstructing it, rearranging it, abstracting its meaning, is it sort of a way of reclaiming it, is also calling it out, and really makes you think. And so I found that a really interesting combination when you have this landscape romantic tradition with a lot of white male painters who are coming up from out of state, who are making these representations of the place, and people were writing about it like it was really real, or that they had such a good knowledge of place. And there is an element of that, but they're also very idealized or romanticized images that often look more like the lower 48 West than the Alaska West, and they're removing people, they're removing so many things that it really changes the meaning.
You know, I remember from the walkthrough, and I remember Kes weighing in on this when he joined the group. I think maybe someone in the group asked the question, or maybe Brittany, you just posed it. Are these realistic depictions, these romantic, are they realistic? And, you know, then it followed that sometimes there's no people here. You know, the landscape is too big for people. Or if you see people in the landscape, they're itty bitty. They're dwarfed by this enormous landscape. And then, of course, that changes. There's other paintings where it's not like that. But I think you, Brittany, said that, well, these depictions were appropriate for the time, but they are romantic. They are overblown. And so could you speak a little to that? And then I think, Kes, you really talked a lot about almost the burden of having such a great landscape, you know, being the Alaska story. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I don't think of it necessarily as appropriate for the time, but as sort of, I guess, reminiscent of it, or what was happening. Whether or not it was appropriate or okay, it was debatable for years. But it was coming off of a lot of landscape painting theory and thinking about this idea of the sublime, that man kind of versus nature, and being out in this enormous, what they're considering untamed sort of wild space, made them think about their own smallness in the universe as a whole, and made them think about their own death in that sense. If I'm this small and this place is so big and it's wild, and so there was a fear element there that then translated into a sense of awe, a sense of beauty, and sort of a spiritual kind of take on the landscape. So they were representing it often in that way. And some of these painters would exaggerate and make mountains taller or sunlight different. They'd add more mist to kind of enunciate those thought processes. And that's also why you see tiny figures or no figures, is that it really was talking about the landscape being more important or powerful than mankind, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And Kes, you talked a little bit about that, almost that we're still living with that giant landscape today, even though many people live here. You know, you can find things here that you could find anywhere in the lower 48, kinds of services, kinds of businesses, kinds of dwellings. And yet we still have this great land story. And what can you add to that discussion?
The thing that I'm always interested in talking to people about with paintings, with images in art, is that it's not a question so much of whether the work is real or realistic or accurate as acknowledging that there is no such thing as an objective image. Every image made by an artist is subjective. And the same artist, at even during the same period, can look at the same place and say something entirely different about it. In that first gallery, there are two huge paintings, one by Sidney Lawrence, the most beloved historical Alaskan painter, and another by his contemporary, Eustace Ziegler, on the same wall, practically side by side, and they say totally opposite things about Alaska. Sidney Lawrence says the Alaskan landscape is large, people are puny and insignificant, that the landscape is invulnerable. And Eustace Ziegler says, painting exactly the same places, this is a place where if people are strong enough and bold enough and ambitious enough, they can match the mountains. And so he puts people in the foreground and he makes them larger and he makes them the focus of the work more than the landscape. And all of us who have tried to make art in Alaska since their time have to think about not just those two depictions, but other ways of looking at the landscape and decide whether we want to follow one of those models or another model, or whether we want to come up with new models of our own. And one of the greatest things about these new galleries is that you can, if you go through asking yourself not what's being depicted, but what those paintings actually have to say about the relationship to people in this place, then you can see a panoply of different answers to that question.
That's very interesting. I believe there was, if I'm remembering right, a Thomas Hill painting where, I can't think of the name of it, but there are people in that painting and they're small and it's kind of on a beach, and I believe we talked about how it changed. There at one point was a boat in that picture. Am I making any sense, Bethany? Does this ring a bell?
Yes. There's a couple versions of that painting. So one of them. You know, the scale of the people changes a little bit or how clearly you can see them. But there's an image of people on the shore with a boat and then also a steamship coming through the water. So it was kind of talking about also what we're thinking about with in terms of scale and also about this idea that tourism was coming to the region and that it was sort of the meeting of these multiple worlds.
Very, very interesting. Go ahead, Cass.
John Muir had invited Thomas Hill to come up and paint the glacier that was being named for him, Muir Glacier, during one of the first years in which steamships were coming up the Inside Passage and bringing tourists to Alaska. And the original painting that he did is in the Oakland Museum, and it's about half the size of the one in the Anchorage Museum. And it's a pretty realistic, it's romantic, but a pretty realistic image of the steamship off in the waters and the face of the glacier at a pretty much appropriate scale. And on the shore, you see the tourists from the ship buying curios from the native people who are on shore. And so there's a kind of depiction of these meetings of two cultures on the beach there. It's very much about that. So 3 years later, Thomas Hill paints the painting that is in the Anchorage Museum, and the people have been completely eliminated from the painting. The face of the glacier has grown to twice as high. The ship has become tinier. One of the most important things I tell people to look for when you have landscape paintings is what's the scale of the human-made environment versus the natural environment, because that tells you a lot about how the artist is seeing that place. And the only indication that there are any native people in Alaska at all in that painting, in the painting that's in the Anchorage Museum, is this Tlingit canoe that's over in the shadows off in the distance, and it's very telling.
Hmm. You know, before we leave this room, I just want to mention the George Brown collection, just because this was the son of Belmore Brown, and I had heard of Belmore Brown, didn't know about George Brown, but he climbed McKinley and painted like plein air, so he had, you know, it's just an amazing story. I actually attended a close-up at the museum where they choose a piece of art and you can learn a whole lot more in a half an hour on a Friday evening about that piece of artwork, and it's really fun. And so that's in the main room too, and it sort of tells the story of the painter as he begins to ascend. And I think that the educator there told us that he got to 11,000 feet, but after that, his paint was frozen and he just couldn't do anymore. But it's just kind of a daunting ambition to paint, to carry everything with you to climb Denali and paint along the way and carry all of that back with you. I mean, it just was stunning to me. So that's another element in that opening room. Anything else you guys want to add about that?
I think every plein air painter in Alaska who prides him or herself on working out of doors in difficult conditions should go in and see that group of paintings. It's just incredible. It's the ne plus ultra of plein air painting. And you can look at those paintings and you can follow him up the mountain. You can see in the way they're painted, the paint getting stiffer and stiffer as he goes higher and the temperature gets colder. And then you can see it starting to freeze and break up. And it's an incredible tour de force of plein air painting. And it's just wonderful that Bettany thought of including that entire group of paintings in that space, because it needs that much space to see the whole impact of the piece and to get a sense of what he accomplished.
Right. We have to move on because we're only in the first room, right? We're going to start to talk a little bit about the second room, which is really interesting too. You leave this big airy white space where it almost feels like you can just breathe and take in this artwork, and then you move into a room that is, the walls are olive colored. That's my memory anyway, sort of olive. It's kind of a much, much quieter kind of space. And I want to talk about that one wall where there are maybe 15 pieces of art arranged on the wall. And I think, Bettany, you called it a salon-style display of artwork. So instead of walking along a wall and seeing a painting here, and then you move a few feet and you see a painting there, you're looking at a wall. And talk about putting that together. And Kes, chime in at any point on that. And I'll probably have to interrupt you in the middle because we're going to take a little break. And then, in fact, maybe we'll take our break and come back and start with that, so I don't have to interrupt you. So we're going to be right back. We're talking with Kes Woodward and Bettany Porter about the Art of the North Gallery at the Anchorage Museum. And you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. And welcome back, Bettany Porter, curator of the Anchorage Museum's Gallery of the North, and also to Kes Woodward, who's joining us from KUAC in Fairbanks, an art historian, an artist who's got work in this gallery, but also has spent a long time learning and working with Alaska artists and their work. As we were just going to take the break, we were going to start talking about the second room. But before I do that, let me just share our numbers, 550-8433 in Anchorage, and we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org or give us a call at 1-888-353-5752 if you're outside of Anchorage. But let's go back to that room, because moving from the big airy room, light, into a more focused space, and that wall where I think there's something like 14 pieces on anchored by, you know, several Sidney Lawrences, a Fred Maccatance, a Eustace Ziegler, Theodore Lambert. Tell us about putting that wall together. And I don't think you could miss it. Once you step into that room, you can't miss that wall.
Sure. So part of the idea of this exhibition was to highlight some of the romantic landscapes from our permanent collection. And we have in this show over 250 artworks. So part of the tricky part of that is how do you get a lot of works out on display and still make it interesting? And so we just had talked early on about the idea of a salon-style wall. And the salon is typically they used to do it in Paris. In the Paris salons, they would hang artwork floor to ceiling, and they were usually large-scale paintings. So you could see a lot of works at once, and it was often very overwhelming, and sometimes the walls were red. So we were kind of playing off that idea. It's definitely a contemporary kind of version of that, so it's not all the way floor to ceiling, but you do have about three or four paintings high, and as you said, you know, there's about 14 to 24 paintings in a lot of those grids. So
Oh, I'm just saying, so the organizing principle behind that was the romantic landscape?
Yes, that gallery is really looking at sort of the romantic north. So you are seeing a lot of those late 1800s, early 1900s paintings. Like you said, Sidney Lawrence, Eustace Ziegler, Fred Maccatance, who's a little bit later, but still kind of in that sort of well-known group of artists that were known for painting an Alaskan landscape.
It's a very powerful view. You know, there's different size paintings, and there's a great, if you don't recognize the paintings, there's a great guide to the right. And I found myself going back and forth and reading about, you know, Sidney Lawrence's and Fred Maccatance and even some people I had never heard of. I think this might be a kind of a nice time to talk a little bit about Fred Maccatance, because he has a big piece in there. And I learned from reading about him that he came to Alaska and actually, I think, visiting an uncle in Unalakleet, and John, chime in, Cass, if I've got this right or wrong, but his depictions of Alaska are really from an Alaska Native perspective of Alaska Natives thriving in the landscape. And so you see, you know, fishing and sailing and hunting. So tell me a little bit about it. And I understand that he was welcomed into Unalakleet and was, you know, going along with a lot of these activities and had a unique opportunity to try to capture Alaska Natives in the landscape. Is that right?
Yeah, Fred came to Unalakleet in 1935. His uncle ran the trading post there, and the Native people in the community thoroughly embraced him and taught him how to live in that landscape and how to hunt the animals and how to thrive in that landscape. And he was bowled over by that. He was bowled over by the way that they were able to make this place be not just a challenge or not be something totally daunting, but a friendly place, a welcoming place. And he never forgot that, and he captured that in his images of Native people and also in his images of non-Native people who were thriving in the North at that time. And he could see that things, even that early on, were changing rapidly in Alaska. And so what he set for himself as a goal was to do for Alaska kind of what Frederick Remington did for the American West, to capture a changing way of life that was rapidly changing and was never going to be the same again. And that's what he did for the rest of his life.
And again, people, figure large in his images, right? So they're not overwhelmed by the landscape. I mean, that image of the hunters in the whaling boat, they are the centerpiece of that painting. And again, it's just another way of seeing people in the landscape.
Exactly.
Let's talk just a little bit about, I think it's Fred Mocketons that was inspired by Maxwell Parrish. go ahead and talk about that, because I think that's kind of fun to know, too.
Well, Fred had just graduated from college, and he was an admirer of Maxfield Parrish's work. Maxfield Parrish was probably the best-known artist in America at the time. Some large percentage of American households had reproductions of his paintings on their walls at that time, and he drove across country from Ohio to New Hampshire, where Maxfield Parrish lived, and he was lost, and it was dark, and he finally figured he was pretty close, and so he stopped his car, and he went to sleep overnight in his car, and he woke up the next morning, and he was out in Maxfield Parrish's front yard with his car in the yard, and Maxfield Parrish came out and welcomed him and showed him the way that he worked, which was a fairly unique way at the time. And Fred picked up that way of working and adapted it to Alaskan light and Alaskan conditions and made it his trademark for the rest of his life. This way of working in which you put down a single color with different values, lights and darks, to establish the image and then put layer after layer after layer of transparent glazes on top of that so that the light passes down through those transparent layers and bounces off the white of the canvas, or in Fred's case, almost invariably masonite, primed masonite, and illuminates it almost like a stained glass window from behind.
Mm-hmm. That special quality of light. I mean, that's something for me. I just want to interject here. You know, I live in Alaska. I go hiking in the Chugach, and in the winter in the Chugach, the light, even especially as the sun starts to go down, there's a, I think it's a Sidney Lawrence painting called Sunset on Snow that captures that pink orange right at the horizon. I mean, that's what's so fun about going to this gallery. We live in the same place these people were depicting, and we see some of their inspiration or feel inspired ourselves. I know many times I've gone, driven the road in Denali National Park and thought, I feel so insignificant in this space, looking out at these big mountains and these big river valleys. You know, it's just, I feel somewhat like, not like you're walking in their footsteps, but you have some sense of what it was like for them to try then to capture this, whether it's the light or the landscape. There's one more Fred Mocketons story I want you to tell, Kes, which is he has some polar bears, and it's my understanding that he never actually saw a polar bear in the wild, and yet he's placed polar bears in the wild. And just tell us the story behind that.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because he did hunt with the Inuit people in the Arctic and with Inupiaq hunters in the Arctic. And so he could very well have seen a polar bear in the wild, but he and his wife Sarah traveled to the lower 48 every winter for many years and showed slides and films that they made about Alaska. And whenever he went to a city in the lower 48, he would visit zoos, and he would take photographs of the polar bears in those zoos. And of course, towards the end of his life, there was a polar bear in the Alaska Zoo there in Anchorage, and he took pictures of that polar bear as well. And so he told me and others that it was kind of funny, because he had actually never seen a polar bear in the wild, even though it was one of his trademark images.
I just thought that was funny, you know, just taking it in. Now, I know we've been staying in the Romantic period, and I know, you know, we have to move on. But, Bettany, there's kind of a second room there with these olive-colored walls where, you know, the artwork is really popping off the wall. And there's a glass case there. Well, actually, before we leave Fred, there's a beautiful collection of lithographs from Fred that I wish you would talk a little bit about. I had no idea that you know, the person who does these luminescent scenes of Alaska also did these lithographs, and they're very soulful. You know, a woman with a baby on her back, a hunter. They're just really beautiful. Tell us a little bit about them, Kes or Betney, whoever. I think many people might not know that about Fred Makatans.
Sure. Well, we can sort of tag team it probably. There's a wonderful copy actually in the archives in our rare book collection of a book called The 50 Stone Lithographs of Fred Makatans that he and his wife Sarah wrote. And it has stories on each of those images that you see on the wall. So that's just a section of some of the lithographs that we own. But he was really captivated by the scenery and the people that he met, and so he had become, as we talked about, a resident artist. So he's sort of showing a lot of the imagery from his experience, both with whaling crews and dog sleds and living in cabins, and also some of these were people who were well known at the time and in the paper a lot, and he would actually go out and try to meet them and make images of them.
Mm-hmm.
So Kes may have a little more to say. I'm not sure on.
And you know what? What is a lithograph? I guess they're black and white, right?
These are black and white, and they're made from limestone, from Bavarian limestone. That it's an interesting process, and Fred learned it in New York from a well-known artist, Will Barnett, and he made a couple of the first lithographs himself in New York, and then the rest of them he came back to Alaska to his home outside Palmer, and he took one of these large, very heavy pieces of Bavarian limestone. And the way you make a lithograph on stone is you draw on the surface of the stone with a greasy substance, with a black pencil, or you can use ink wash that has a greasy substance in it. And you create the image, and then you flood when the printer prints it, the printer floods the surface of the limestone with water, and it works on the principle that oil and water don't mix. And so everywhere that the image has been drawn on with this greasy substance attracts the ink that's rolled onto the limestone surface with a roller, and everywhere that the water is, it repels the ink. And it's a very exacting process. And Fred would send his plates, his stones back to New York, and they would print several different proofs, lighter and darker, and in various ways, and they would send him the proofs, and he would mark them up, and he would say, make this a little lighter or make this a little darker, and that would go back and forth and back and forth, and then eventually he would write on one of them, BAT, bon à tirer, good to pull, and so then they would print the edition. And so it's quite an elaborate process.
And it's a nice wall. It's a wall of about 20 of them, and it's really stunning and worth looking for in that second room. And there's one more thing I want to ask Betney to speak to, because you spoke to it. There's a showcase there of Sidney Lawrence studies. And when you talked to us about it, you said, you know, you're an artist yourself, and it really was fun for you to see his you know, the early versions of work. So talk a little bit about that. It's a large showcase where you can really look up close to see some of his sketches and studies.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we own in the collection over a couple hundred of his drawings. And so we decided to put together two tables with a selection of those drawings. And they're about 3 by 4 inches. They're very tiny. Some of them he's written notes or possible titles on. And some of them are, very similar to some of the paintings in that gallery. But part of the reason of including that was to show sort of the process and train of thought. And a lot of these artists were working plein air and going out and making sketches or studies. So it was really interesting to see that. And similar, we talked about George Brown earlier. He had built a case to carry all of his paintings. And so I was kind of thinking about all these moments and these artists going out and setting up and thinking about their landscape before sort of these final works. And we also have a huge prints and drawings collection in the exhibit. So it was kind of a segue to some of the other prints and drawings that you may see throughout the show.
You know, before we leave that room, there's one other painting that I think it might have been Kes that spoke to it, but it was it's an Alaska scene where there are strong northern lights in the sky, and the discussion was that this was in the permanent collection, but it was so dark it needed to be cleaned. You couldn't even see the northern lights, and I think it was you, Kes, that talked about what a treat it was to see it and to see the northern lights, and it very, very vibrant. So maybe you could speak to that, and maybe, you know, we don't know about how you have to take care of paintings or how they need to be refreshed or cleaned. So I thought that was an opportunity to talk a little bit about that.
Bethany, do you want to talk about the conservation of that painting?
Sure, I can talk a little bit. I don't know all of the details, but I know that it had, it was very, it's a dark painting anyway. It's a Carl Saxild painting, and you see kind of imagery of the railroad and the northern lights, and it's one that people are really attracted to. It's always something we want to use, but it had some, it was dirty, and I think there was also a tear in it, and so this was a wonderful opportunity that this show had a large budget for conservation that we could actually pay conservators to clean and kind of fix these pieces that we've always wanted to be able to show but maybe couldn't because they still needed a lot of work. And there's also a time element to that. Sometimes you need several months or even a year in advance knowledge to really do the proper conservation techniques. And we have both phenomenal people on site, and also sometimes we'll bring in experts in a certain medium, like a painting conservator may be flown up to look at some of the work.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think, Kes, you remarked about how happy you were to get to see it because it wasn't available for such a long time.
Right. And, you know, that whole end of the wall in that gallery are, I think, three large paintings by Carl Saxild. And he was one of a dozen WPA artists who came up in 1937 as part of the Alaska Art Project during the Works Progress Administration as an effort to sort of publicize the territories of the U.S. It was intended to be Alaska and Hawaii and the Virgin Islands, and they only ever did Alaska. It was very expensive, and they never completed the project, and they never had an exhibition of the work. And one of the great things that the Anchorage Museum has done over the years is to try to track down some of the hundreds of works that they did either on that several-month stay in Alaska or when they went back to their studios, mostly in the Midwest, after they were here.
Yeah, until I was there, I had no idea that we had a WPA artist project on Alaska. So that was really neat to discover that. There are more rooms, but before we leave this one, there's just one painting I want to talk about. It's actually a ink and watercolor on skin, and it is called Radio Babies. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yes, it's in the South Gallery.
Oh, is it? I'm in the wrong gallery. It's the Art of the North Gallery.
Very close.
but I just wanted to mention it because we're going to move into those galleries anyway. But this one really captured me so much because Radio Babies is just such a funny idea. And so it's like you have to step closer and see what it's about. And it's a sketch by George Akupuk, circa 1940. And this artist was best known for his drawings on the treated skins of seals, reindeer, and caribou that he hunted. But pictured in this is Joseph Romig. So we've all heard of Romig Junior High, right? Romig was a well-known doctor in Alaska. And in the painting, he's offering advice over the radio to an expectant mother in Bethel. So you see him in a little building, and he's on the kind of like on the phone, and she's in another building in the painting, and she's in bed, obviously,
in labor.
In labor, yeah. And but the baby soars over the airwaves to an antenna in Bethel, where his parents anxiously await his arrival. I'm reading some of the description, and it's just such a fanciful idea depicted, and it's fun to just, call it out and talk about it. So let's see. I'm going to throw our numbers out one more time just in case people have questions or if they just want to share an experience of being in this gallery. It's 550-8433 in Anchorage or email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And again, we're speaking with Kes Woodward up at KUAC in Fairbanks, but an artist and an art historian. Really knowledgeable about Alaska and its artists. And also we have Bettany Porter, who curated this gallery, the Gallery of the North in the Anchorage Museum. You know, Bettany, I want to kind of move out into that other kind of high-ceilinged, it feels a little bit like a long, narrow room. There's video. We're moving away from the sort of romantic historical views of Alaska, but more toward the way current contemporary artists are talking about this space. So could you introduce us to that space a little bit? I know there are some Sonia Keller Combs pieces there. There's a video at the far end. There's a number of really interesting pieces. What's going on here and how are we moving through time?
Sure. So this is the Cross Gallery, which when you come in, if you turn to the right, it's a long, skinny gallery in the center. With an atrio window at the far end. And so this was the space we were thinking of as the contemporary gallery. So you'll see a lot of perspectives of the North that are maybe looking more at identity, or they're looking at kind of environmental impacts on the landscape. So it's a really different perspective than the romanticized North. You're seeing imagery of climate change effects in villages. You're seeing artworks that deal with suicide or abuse, or even terms that are used to define Native and what that looks like and how that is sort of quantified by the government. So there's a lot of really complex ideas in that space.
Yeah, really, really interesting. You're moving away from the romantic into the real, or I don't know. What do you think, Kes? I mean, it's they're all Alaskans or people visiting Alaska trying to give us a feel for the place, but it's so different in this contemporary gallery. It feels really different.
Yeah, you know, I resist using this set of opposites of romantic and real.
Okay.
I think that every image made by an artist tells us something about how that artist experienced the landscape. And it was the experience that Sidney Lawrence and Eustace Ziegler and Ted Lambert and Fred Mocketance had is just as real as the experience that we contemporary artists have in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
But what that third gallery does so well, I think, is to show how complex and how fraught the contemporary landscape in Alaska is. It acknowledges things like climate change very, very directly. It acknowledges colonization of Native people and the effort of a whole generation of contemporary Alaska Native artists to decolonize themselves and retake their cultural traditions. And there is a wide range of work in that third gallery. It's not as if it all comes from the same place or from the same people or from the same culture. It takes lots of different points of view as well. But what it does collectively is it shows the very complex and fraught and mixed cultural and climatic and social place that Alaska is today.
Mm-hmm. In the slideshow that we have on the website, I have a piece that's called Mother Nature. I think is it Mother Nature Doesn't Love You?
Or, doesn't love you, yeah.
And it's in the faint of shape of almost an oriental fan. I think the artist might be Tom Chung, something like that, and
right.
And it looks like an Alaska Native young man with two guns in each hand pointing at, I think, polar bears. You know, and the polar bears look very ferocious, and I mean it's very interesting. I don't know what to say, but I just had to stop and spend time and just kind of absorb it a little bit, and I'll be thinking about it for a long time. So. Bettany, do you think we should move into the final room? And am I right that we have a final room where there are contemporary Alaska Native masks? Kes, I think there's your artwork of Polychrome Pass, I think, is right in there. And there's some other really gorgeous landscapes, but they're not in that romantic tradition. They are different. And so let's talk about that final room, which is a very big room with lots of artwork, including some sculptures, too. Let's talk about that. Bettany, maybe start off a little bit.
Sure. So this room is a little bit kind of in between. It's a lot of work from the 80s and 90s. It's a lot of landscape painters who were going out to Fairbanks and in the Brooks Range and painting sometimes together. And it sort of started off thinking more as like a more personal sort of narrative experience of place. And that's also where we find even some earlier works, Mock Stunts and Radio Babies, and there's stone sculptures. There's also masks, and there are, it's kind of a mix of things in that space.
Very, very interesting. And Kes, maybe talk a little bit about that Polychrome Pass painting, because I'm so used to snow and birch trees and warm light, and this is different for you, at least from my limited experience. So talk a little bit about that painting.
Yeah, that's a painting that the Rasmussen Foundation bought for the museum in honor of Pat Wolf when she retired as director of the museum. And it's a painting that I did on one of my earliest trips as an artist in residence in Denali National Park. I was the first artist in residence there and wrote the guidelines for the program and have worked with it ever since. And it's, like most of my work, my attempt to try to make an image not so much of what a place looks like as what it felt like to me to be there at a particular time of year and a particular quality of light and time of day. Mm. And that's something that takes me a long time to distill. So I'm sort of the opposite of a plein air painter.
Well, it's very beautiful, very colorful, sweeping, and so to me different from many of the studies of birch trees that I love also very much, you know, and so it's just really fun to see that. I also attended a close-up last Friday where they were talking about one of the masks on the wall, and I'm just mentioning these close-ups so if people feel like they want to learn more, there's these opportunities. But it's a piece called Punk Nanook Inua from 1986, made out of metal, plastic, feathers, and rubber by Lawrence James Beck. And it's really fun, but you know what? You guys, you can hear the music. It means that we are out of time. So I am so, so glad that you were able to join us and give us kind of a walking tour and the stories behind a lot of the artwork. So I just want to thank you so much, Bettany Porter, curator for the Art of the North Gallery, Kes Woodward, artist and art historian, speaking with us from KUAC in Fairbanks. Thanks to them for helping us get this together. I'll be back as your host on the next Hometown Alaska when we'll do a show requested by our listeners during our All Ears show earlier this year on the story of stray animals in Anchorage. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.